ruin her. And like every witch that ever rode a broom straight through the night to a ceremonial infanticide, as thrilled by the black wind as by the rod between her legs, like every fed-up-to-the-teeth bride who worried about the consistency of the grits she threw at her husband, as well as the potency of the lie she had stirred into them. And like every queen and every courtesan who was struck by the beauty of her emerald ring as she tipped its poison into the old red wine, Hager was energized by the details of her mission. She stalked him. Whenever the fist that beat in her chest became that pointing finger, when any contact with him at all was better than none, she stalked him. She could not get his love, and the possibility that he did not think of her at all was intolerable. So she settled for his fear. On those days, her hair standing out from her head like a thundercloud, she haunted Southside and not Doctor Street until she found him. Sometimes it took 2 days or three, and the people who saw her passed the word along that Hager done took off after Milkman again. Women watched her out of their windows. Men looked up from their checker games and wondered if she'd make it this time. The lengths to which lost love drove men and women never surprised them. They had seen women pull their dresses over their heads and howl like dogs for lost love. And men who sat in doorways with pennies in their mouths for lost love. Thank God, they whispered to themselves. Thank God I ain't never had one of them graveyard loves. Empire State himself was a good example of one. He'd married a white girl in France and brought her home. Happy as a fly and just as industrious, he lived with her for 6 years until he came home to find her with another man, another black man. And when he discovered that his white wife loved not only him, not only this other black man, but the whole race, he sat down, closed his mouth, and never said another word. Railroad Tommy had given him a janitor's job to save him from the poorhouse, workhouse, or nuthouse one. So Hager's forays were part and parcel of the mystery of having been lifed by love. And while the manifestation it took was a source of great interest to them, the consequences were not. After all, it served him right, messing with his own cousin. Luckily for Milkman, she had proved, so far, to be the world's most inept killer. Awed, even in the midst of her anger, by the very presence of her victim, she trembled violently, and her knife thrusts and hammer swings and ice-pick jabs were clumsy. As soon as the attempt had been thwarted by a wrist grab from behind, or a body tackle from the front, or a neat clip on the jaw, she folded up into herself and wept cleansing tears right there. And later, under Pilate's strap, to which she submitted with relief, Pilate beat her, Reba cried, and Hager crouched. Until the next time, like this time, when she turned the doorknob of Guitar's little bachelor room. It was locked. So she swung one leg over the porch railing and fiddled with the window. Milkman heard the noises, heard the window shake, but refused to move or take his arm away from his eyes, even when he heard the tinkle and clatter of glass He did not move. Hagar put her shoe back on before reaching into the window hole she had made and turning the catch. It took her the longest time to raise the window. She was hanging lopsided over the railing, one leg supporting her weight. The window slid in a crooked path up its jamb. Milkman refused to look. Perspiration collected in the small of his back and ran out of his armpit down his side. But the fear was gone. He lay there as still as the morning light and sucked the world's energy up into his own will and willed her dead. Either she will kill me or she will drop dead. Either I am to live in this world on my terms or I will die out of it. If I am to live in it, then I want her dead. One or the other. Me or her. Choose. Die, Hagar. Die. 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 But she didn't. She crawled into the room and walked over to the little iron bed. In her hand was a butcher knife, which she raised high over her head and brought down heavily toward the smooth neck flesh that showed above his shirt collar. The knife struck his collarbone and angled off to his shoulder. A small break in the skin began to bleed. Milkman jerked, but did not move his arm nor open his eyes. Hagar raised the knife again, this time with both hands, but she found she could not get her arms down. Try as she might, the ball joint in her shoulders would not move. 10 seconds passed. 15. The paralyzed woman and the frozen man. At the 30th second, Milkman knew he had won. He moved his arm and opened his eyes. His gaze traveled to her strung-up, held-up arms. Oh, she thought, when she saw his face, I had forgotten how beautiful he is. Milkman sat up, swung his legs over the side of the bed, and stood. If you keep your hands just that way, he said, and then bring them down straight, straight and fast, you can drive that knife right smack in your cunt. Why don't you do that? Then all your problems will be over. He patted her cheek and turned away from her wide, dark, pleading, hollow eyes. She stood that way for a long time, and it was an even longer time before anybody found her. They could have guessed where she was, though. If anybody missed her for a while, they could guess. Even Ruth knew now. A week earlier, she had learned from Freddy that Hagar had tried to kill Milkman 6 times in as many months. She stared at his golden teeth and said, Hagar? She hadn't laid eyes on her in years, had been to Pilot's house only once in her life, a very long time ago. Hagar? Hagar. Sure, Hagar. Does Pilot know? Course she do. Whip her every time, but it don't do no good. Ruth was relieved. For a moment, she imagined that Pilot, who had brought her son into life in the first place, was now bound to see him dead. But right after that moment of relief, she felt hurt because Milkman had not told her himself. Then she realized that he really didn't tell her anything, and hadn't for years. Her son had never been a person to her, a separate, real person. He had always been a passion. Because she had been so desperate to lie with her husband and have another baby by him, the son she bore was first off a wished-for bond between herself and Macon, something to hold them together and reinstate their sex lives. Even before his birth, he was a strong feeling, a feeling about the nasty greenish-gray powder Pilot had given her to be stirred into rainwater and put into food. But Macon came out of his few days of sexual hypnosis in a rage, and later, when he discovered her pregnancy, tried to get her to abort. Then the baby became the nausea caused by the half ounce of castor oil Macon made her drink, then a hot pot recently emptied of scalding water on which she sat, then a soapy enema, a knitting needle. She inserted only the tip, squatting in the bathroom, crying, afraid of the man who paced outside the door. And finally, when he punched her stomach, she had been about to pick up his breakfast plate when he looked at her stomach and punched it. She ran to Southside, looking for Pilot. She had never walked through that part of town, but she knew the street Pilot lived on, though not the house. Pilot had no telephone and no number on her house. Ruth had asked some passerby where Pilot lived and was directed to a lean brown house set back from the unpaved road. Pilot was sitting on a chair. Reba was cutting Pilot's hair with barber's clippers. That was the first time she saw Hager, who was 4 or 5 years old then. Chubby, with 4 long braids, 2 like horns over each ear, 2 like tails at the back of her neck. Pilot comforted Ruth, gave her a peach, which Ruth could not eat because the fuzz made her sick. She listened to what Ruth said and sent Reba to the store for a box of Argo cornstarch. She sprinkled a little of it into her hand and offered it to Ruth, who obediently took a lump and put it in her mouth. As soon as she tasted it, felt its crunchiness, she asked for more and ate half a box before she left. From then on, she ate cornstarch, cracked ice, nuts, and once in a fit, she put a few tiny pebbles of gravel in her mouth. When you expect, you have to eat what the baby craves, Pilot said, lest it come in the world hungry for what you denied it. Ruth could not bite enough. Her teeth were on edge with yearning. Like the impulse of a cat to claw, she searched for crunchy things, and when there was nothing, she would grind her teeth. Gnashing the cornstarch, Ruth let Pilot lead her into the bedroom, where the woman wrapped her in a homemade-on-the-spot girdle, tight in the crotch, and told her to keep it on until the 4th month. And don't take no more mess off Macon. And don't ram another thing up in your womb. She also told her not to worry. Macon would bother her no more. She, Pilot, would see to it. Years later, Ruth learned that Pilot put a small doll on Macon's chair in his office, a male doll with a small painted chicken bone stuck between its legs and a round red circle painted on its belly. Macon knocked it out of the chair and with a yardstick pushed it into the bathroom, where he doused it with alcohol and burned it. It took 9 separate burnings before the fire got down to the straw and cotton ticking of its insides. But he must have remembered the round, fire-red stomach, for he left Ruth alone after that. When the baby was born, the day after she stood in the snow, with cloth roses at her feet and a man with blue wings above her head, she regarded him as a beautiful toy, a respite, a distraction, a physical pleasure as she nursed him. Until Freddie, again Freddie, caught her at it. Then he was no longer her velveteen toy. He became a plane on which, like cowboys and Indians in the movies, she and her husband fought, each one befuddled by the values of the other, each one convinced of his own purity and outraged by the idiocy he saw in the other. She was the Indian, of course, and lost her land, her customs, her integrity to the cowboy, and became a spread-eagled footstool, resigned to her fate and holding fast to tiny, irrelevant defiances. But who was this son of hers, this tall man who had flesh on the outside and feelings on the inside that she knew nothing of, but somebody did, knew enough about him to want to kill him? Suddenly, the world opened up for her like one of her imperial tulips and revealed its evil yellow pistol. She had been husbanding her own misery, shaping it, making of it an art and a way. Now she saw a larger, more malevolent world outside her own. Outside the four-poster bed where Doctor had bubbled and rotted, all but his beautiful hands, which were the only things his grandson had inherited. Outside her garden and the fishbowl where her goldfish died, she had thought it was all done, that she had won out over the castor oil and the pot of steam that had puckered and burned her skin so she could not bear to urinate or sit with her daughters at the table where they cut and sewed. She had had the baby anyway, and although it did nothing to close the break between herself and Macon, there he was, her single triumph. Now Freddie was telling her that it wasn't done and over yet. Somebody was still trying to kill him, to deprive her of the one aggressive act brought to royal completion. And the person who was threatening his life was someone who shared Macon's blood. "That hurts," she said aloud to Freddie as she folded into her pocket the rent money he handed her. "That hurts, you know." She climbed the porch steps and went into the kitchen. Without knowing what her foot was planning to do, she kicked the cabinet door with the worn lock under the sink. It answered her kick with a tiny whine before it sneaked open again. Ruth looked at it and kicked it closed once more. Again it whined and opened right back up. "I want you closed," she whispered. "Closed." The door stayed open. "Closed. You hear me? Closed. Closed. Closed." She was screaming by now. Magdalene Colina, hearing her shouts, ran down the stairs and into the kitchen. She found her mother staring at the sink and commanding it. "Mother?" Lena was frightened. Ruth looked up at her. "What is it?" "I don't know. I thought I heard you saying something." "Get somebody to fix that door. I want it shut, tight." Lena stared as Ruth hurried past, and when she heard her mother running up the stairs, she put her fingers to her lips in disbelief. Ruth was 62 years old. Lena had no idea she could move that fast. Her passions were narrow but deep, long deprived of sex, long dependent on self-manipulation. She saw her son's imminent death as the annihilation of the last occasion she had been made love to. With the same determined tread that took her to the graveyard 6 or 7 times a year, Ruth left the house and caught the number 26 bus and sat down right in back of the driver. She took her glasses off and wiped them on the hem of her skirt. She was serene and purposeful as always when death turned his attention to someone who belonged to her, as she was when death breathed in her father's wispy hair and blew the strands about. She had the same calmness and efficiency with which she cared for the doctor, putting her hand on death's chest and holding him back, denying him, keeping her father alive even past the point where he wanted to be alive, past pain, on into disgust and horror at having to smell himself in his next breath. Past that, until he was too sick to fight her efforts to keep him alive. Lingering in absolute hatred of this woman who would not grant him peace, but kept her shining, lightish eyes fixed on him like magnets, holding him from the narrow earth he longed for. Ruth wiped her glasses clean so she could see the street signs as they passed. "Eat cherries," Pilot had told her, "and you won't have to wear them little windows over your eyes." Her mind empty except for getting there to Darling Street, where Pilot lived and where she supposed Hager lived too. How had that chubby little girl, weighed down with hair, become a knife-wielding would-be killer out to get her son? Maybe Freddy lied. Maybe. She'd see. When the banks disappeared and small shops in between rickety houses came into view, Ruth pulled the cord. She stepped down and walked toward the underpass that cut across Darling Street. It was a long walk, and she was sweating by the time she got to Pilot's house. The door was open, but nobody was inside. The house smelled fruity, and she remembered how the peach had nauseated her the last time she was there. Here was the chair she had collapsed in. There, the candlemaker's rack, the pan where Pilot's homemade soap hardened into a yellowish brown slab. This house had been a haven then, and in spite of the cold anger she felt now, it still looked like an inn, a safe harbor. A flypaper roll entirely free of flies curled down from the ceiling, not far from a sack that hung there too. Ruth looked into the bedroom and saw three little beds, and like Goldilocks, she walked over to the nearest one and sat down. There was no back door to this two-room house, just a big room where they lived and this bedroom. It had a cellar that one could enter only from the outside under a metal door that slanted away from the house and opened onto stone stairs. Ruth sat still, letting the anger and determination gel. She wondered whose bed it was, and lifted up the blanket and saw only mattress ticking. The same was true of the next bed, but not of the third. It had sheets, a pillow, and a pillow slip. That would be Hager's, she thought. The anger ungelled and flooded through her. She left the room, pressing her fury back so she would be able to wait and wait until somebody returned. Pacing the floor of the outer room, her elbows in the palms of her hands, she suddenly heard humming that seemed to be coming from the back of the house. Pilot, she thought. Pilot hummed and chewed things all the time. Ruth would ask her, first, if what Freddy said was true. She needed Pilot's calm view, her honesty, and equilibrium. Then she would know what to do, whether to unfold her arms and let the rage out to do whatever it might, or she tasted again the Argo cornstarch and felt the marvelous biting and crunching it allowed her. Now she merely ground her teeth as she stepped out to the porch and made her way around the side of the house, through the nicotania growing all wild and out of control. A woman sat on a bench, her hands clasped between her knees. It was not Pilot. Ruth stood still and looked at the woman's back. It didn't look like Death's back at all. It looked vulnerable, soft, like an easily wounded shin, full of bone but susceptible to the slightest pain. "Reba," she said. The woman turned around and fastened on her the most sorrowful eyes Ruth had ever seen. "Reba's gone," she said, the second word sounding as if the going were permanent. "Can I do something for you?" "I'm Ruth Foster." Hager stiffened. A lightning shot of excitement ran through her. Milkman's mother, the silhouette she had seen through the curtains in an upstairs window on evenings when she stood across the street, hoping at first to catch him, then hoping just to see him, finally just to be near the things he was familiar with. Private vigils, held at night, made more private because they were expressions of public lunacy. The outline she'd seen once or twice when the side door opened and a woman shook crumbs from a tablecloth or dust from a small rug onto the ground. Whatever Milkman had told her about his mother, whatever she had heard from Pilot and Reba, she could not remember, so overwhelmed was she in the presence of his mother. Hager let her morbid pleasure spread across her face in a smile. Ruth was not impressed. Death always smiled and breathed and looked helpless like a shin bone or a tiny speck of black on the Queen Elizabeth roses or film on the eye of a dead goldfish. "You are trying to kill him." Ruth's voice was matter of fact. "If you so much as bend a hair on his head, so help me Jesus, I will tear your throat out." Hager looked surprised. She loved nothing in the world except this woman's son, wanted him alive more than anybody, but hadn't the least bit of control over the predator that lived inside her. Totally taken over by her anaconda love, she had no self left, no fears, no wants, no intelligence that was her own. So it was with a great deal of earnestness that she replied to Ruth, "I'll try not to, but I can't make you of a certain promise." Ruth heard the supplication in her words, and it seemed to her that she was not looking at a person, but at an impulse, a cell, a red corpuscle that neither knows nor understands why it is driven to spend its whole life in one pursuit, swimming up a dark tunnel toward the muscle of a heart or an eye's nerve end that it both nourished and fed from. Hager lowered her eyelids and gazed hungrily down the figure of the woman who had been only a silhouette to her, the woman who slept in the same house with him, and who could call him home, and he would come, who knew the mystery of his flesh and memory of him as long as his life, the woman who knew him, had watched his teeth appear, stuck her finger in his mouth to soothe his gums, cleaned his behind, Vaselined his penis, and caught his vomit in a fresh white diaper, had fed him from her own nipples, carried him close and warm and safe under her heart, and who had opened her legs far, far wider than she herself ever had for him, who even now could walk freely into his room if she wanted to, and smell his clothes, stroke his shoes, and lay her head on the very spot where he had lain his. But what was more, so much more, this thin, lemon-yellow woman knew with absolute certainty what Hagar would willingly have her throat torn out to know, that she would see him this very day. Jealousy loomed so large in her, it made her tremble. "Maybe you," she thought. "Maybe it's you I should be killing. Maybe then he will come to me and let me come to him. He is my home in this world." And then aloud, "He is my home in this world, and I am his," said Ruth. "And he wouldn't give a pile of swan shit for either one of you." They turned then and saw Pilate leaning on the windowsill. Neither knew how long she'd been there. "Can't say as I blame him, neither. Two growed-up women talking about a man like he was a house or needed one. He ain't a house. He's a man. And whatever he need, don't none of you got it. Leave me alone, Mama, just leave me alone. You already alone. If you want more alone, I can knock you into the middle of next week and leave you there." "You're bothering me," Hagar was shouting and digging her fingers in her hair. It was an ordinary gesture of frustration, but its awkwardness made Ruth know that there was something truly askew in this girl. That here was the wilderness of Southside. Not the poverty or dirt or noise, not just extreme, unregulated passion, where even love found its way with an ice pick, but the absence of control. Here, one lived knowing that at any time, anybody might do anything. Not wilderness, where there was a system, or the logic of lions, trees, toads, and birds, but wild wilderness, where there was none. She had not recognized it in Pilate, whose equilibrium overshadowed all her eccentricities, and who was, in any case, the only person she knew of strong enough to counter Macon. Although Ruth had been frightened of her the first time she saw her, when she knocked on the kitchen door way back then, looking, as she said, for her brother, Macon, Ruth was still frightened of her a little. Not just her short hair cut regularly like a man's, or her large, sleepy eyes and busy lips, or the smooth, smooth skin, hairless, scarless, and wrinkleless. For Ruth had actually seen it, the place on her stomach, where a navel should have been and was not. Even if you weren't frightened of a woman who had no navel, you certainly had to take her very seriously. Now she held up her hand, imperiously, and silenced Hagar's whines. "Sit down there. Sit down and don't leave this yard." Hagar slumped and moved slowly back to her bench. Pilate turned her eyes to Ruth. "Come on in. Rest yourself before you hop on that bus again." They sat down at the table, facing each other. "Peach is kind of dried up on me in this heat," said Pilate, and she reached for a peck basket, which held about a half dozen. "But there should be some good ones left in there. Can I slice you up some?" "No, thank you," said Ruth. She was trembling a little now, after the tension, the anger, the bravado of her earlier state of mind, followed by the violence of Pilate's words to her granddaughter. This quiet, social tea tone disarmed her, threw her too soon and too suddenly, back into the mannered dignity that was habitual for her. Ruth pressed her hands together in her lap to stop the shaking. They were so different, these two women, one black, the other lemony, one corseted, the other buck naked under her dress, one well-read but ill-traveled, the other had read only a geography book, but had been from one end of the country to another, one wholly dependent on money for life, the other indifferent to it. But those were the meaningless things. The similarities were profound. Both were vitally interested in Macon Dead's son. And both had close and supportive posthumous communication with their fathers. The last time I was here, you offered me a peach. My visit was about my son then, too. Pilot nodded her head, and with her right thumbnail, slit the peach open. You won't never be able to forgive her. For just trying to do it, you won't never be able to forgive her. But it looks to me like you ought to be able to understand her. Think on it a minute. You're ready now to kill her. Well, maim her, anyway. Because she's trying to take him away from you. She's the enemy to you, because she wants to take him out of your life. Well, in her eyes, there's somebody who wants to take him out of her life, too. Him. So he's her enemy. He's the one who's trying to take himself out of her life. And she'll kill him before she lets him do that. What I'm saying is that you both got the same idea. I do my best to keep her from it. She's my baby, too, you know. But I tear her up every time she try, just for the trying, mind you, because I know one thing sure, she'll never pull it off. He come in the world trying to keep from getting killed, laying in your stomach. His own papa was trying to do it, and you helped some too. He had to fight off castor oil and knitting needles and being blasted with hot steam and I don't know what all you and Macon did. But he made it. When he was at his most helpless, he made it. Ain't nothing going to kill him but his own ignorance. And won't no woman ever kill him. What's likelier is that it'll be a woman save his life. Nobody lives forever, Pilot. Don't. Of course not. Nobody. Of course nobody. I don't see why not. Death is as natural as life. Ain't nothing natural about death. It's the most unnatural thing there is. You think people should live forever? Some people, yeah. Who's to decide which ones should live and which ones shouldn't? The people themselves. Some folks want to live forever. Some don't. I believe they decide on it anyway. People die when they want to, and if they want to. Don't nobody have to die if they don't want to? Ruth felt a chill. She'd always believed that her father wanted to die. I wish I could count on your faith as far as my son was concerned, but I think I'd be a really foolish woman if I did that. You saw your own father die, just like I did. You saw him killed. Do you think he wanted to die? I saw Papa shot. Blown off a fence, 5 feet into the air. I saw him wiggling on the ground, but not only did I not see him die, I seen him since he was shot. Pilot, you all buried him yourselves. Ruth spoke as if she were talking to a child. Macon did. It's the same thing. Macon seen him too, after he buried him, after he was blown off that fence. We both seen him. I see him still. He's helpful to me, real helpful. Tells me things I need to know. What things? All kinds of things. It's a good feeling to know he's around. I tell you, he's a person I can always rely on. I tell you something else. He's the only one. I was cut off from people early. You can't know what that was like. After my papa was blown off that fence, me and Megan wandered around for a few days until we had a falling out, and I went off on my own. I was about 12, I think, when I cut out by myself. I headed for Virginia. I thought I remembered that was where my papa had people, or my mother did. Seemed to me like I remembered somebody saying that. I don't remember my mother because she died before I was born. Before you were born? How could she? She died, and the next minute I was born. But she was dead by the time I drew air. I never saw her face. I don't even know what her name was. But I do remember thinking she come from Virginia. Anyways, that's where I struck out for. I looked around for somebody to take me in, give me a little work for a while, so I could earn some money to get on down there. I walked for 7 days before I found a place with a preacher's family. A nice place, except they made me wear shoes. They sent me to school, though. A one-room place where everybody sat. I was 12, but since this was my first school, I had to sit over there with the little bitty children. I didn't mind it too much. Matter of fact, I liked a lot of it. I loved the geography part. Learning about that made me want to read. And the teacher was tickled at how much I liked geography. She let me have the book, and I took it home with me to look at. But then the preacher started patting on me. I was so dumb I didn't know enough to stop him. But his wife caught him at it, thumbing my breasts, and put me out. I took my geography book off with me. I could have stayed in that town, 'cause there was plenty of colored people to take me in. In them days, anybody too old to work kept the children. Grown folks worked and left their kids in other people's houses, but him being the preacher and all, like that, I figured out to make tracks. I was broke as a haint, 'cause the place didn't carry no wages, just room and board. So I just took my geography book and a rock I picked up for a souvenir and lit out. It was a Sunday when I met up with some pickers. Folks call them migrants nowadays. Then they were just called pickers. They took me in, treated me fine. I worked up in New York State picking beans. Then we'd move to another place and pick a different crop. Every place I went, I got me a rock. There was about 4 or 5 families all together in the crew, all of them related one way or another. But they was good people and treated me fine. I stayed with them for 3 years, I believe. And the main reason I stayed on was a woman there I took to, a root worker. She taught me a lot and kept me from missing my own family, Macon and Papa. I didn't have a thought in my head of ever leaving them, but I did. I had to. After a while, they didn't want me around no more. Pilot sucked a peach stone, and her face was dark and still with the memory of how she was cut off so early from other people. The boy, the nephew, or was it the cousin of the woman who worked roots? When she was 15 and the rain was so heavy they had to stay in the shacks, those who had them, the others had tents, because nothing could be harvested in that pouring rain. The boy and Pilot lay down together. He was no older than she was. And while everything about her delighted him, nothing about her surprised him. So it was with no malice whatsoever that one evening after supper he mentioned to some of the men, but within listening distance of the women, that he didn't know that some folks had navels and some didn't. The men and the women raised their eyes at his remark and asked him to explain what he meant. He got it out finally, after many false starts. He thought they were alarmed because he had taken the pretty girl with the single earring to bed. But he soon discovered that the navel thing was what bothered them. The root woman was assigned the job of finding out if what he said was true or not. She called Pilate into her shack one day later. "Lay down," she said. "I want to check on something." Pilate lay down on the straw pallet. "Now lift up your dress," the woman said. "More, all the way up, higher." And then her eyes flew open wide, and she put her hand over her mouth. Pilate leaped up. "What? What is it?" She looked down at herself, thinking a snake or a poisonous spider had crawled over her legs. "Nothing," the woman said. Then, "Child, where's your navel?" Pilate had never heard the word navel and didn't know what the woman was talking about. She looked down at her legs, parted on the rough ticking. "Navel?" she asked. "You know, this." And the woman pulled up her own dress and slipped the elastic of her bloomers down over her fat stomach. Pilate saw the little corkscrew thing right in the middle, the little piece of skin that looked like it was made for water to drain down into, like the little whirlpools along the edges of a creek. It was just like the thing her brother had on his stomach. He had one. She did not. He peed standing up, she squatting down. He had a penis like a horse did. She had a vagina, like the mare. He had a flat chest with two nipples. She had teats, like the cow. He had a corkscrew in his stomach. She did not. She thought it was one more way in which males and females were different. The boy she went to bed with had one, too. But until now, she had never seen another woman's stomach. And from the horror on the older woman's face, she knew there was something wrong with not having it. "What's it for?" she asked. The woman swallowed. It's for people who were born natural." Pilate didn't understand that, but she did understand the conversation she had later with the root worker and some other women in the camp. She was to leave. They were very sorry. They liked her and all, and she was such a good worker and a big help to everybody, but she had to leave just the same. "On account of my stomach?" But the women would not answer her. They looked at the ground. Pilate left with more than her share of earnings because the women did not want her to go away angry. They thought she might hurt them in some way if she got angry. And they also felt pity, along with their terror of having been in the company of something God never made. Pilate went away. Again she headed for Virginia, but now she knew how to harvest in a team and looked for another migrant crew or group of women who had followed their men to some seasonal work as brickmakers, iron workers, shipyard workers. In her 3 years picking, she had seen a number of these women, their belongings stuffed into wagons, heading for the towns and cities that sought out and transported black men to various crafts that could be practiced only when the weather permitted. The companies did not encourage the women to come. They did not want an influx of poor colored settlers in those towns. But the women came anyway, and took jobs as domestics and farm helpers in the towns, and lived wherever housing was free or dirt cheap. But Pilate did not want a steady job in a town where a lot of colored people lived. All her encounters with Negroes who had established themselves in businesses or trades in those small Midwestern towns had been unpleasant. Their wives did not like the trembling, unhampered breasts under her dress, and told her so. And though the men saw many raggedy black children, Pilate was old enough to disgrace them. Besides, she wanted to keep moving. Finally, she was taken on by some pickers heading home, stopping for a week's work here and there, wherever they could find it. Again she took a man to bed, and again she was expelled. Only this time, there was no polite but firm pronouncement, nor any generous share of profits. They simply left her one day, moved out while she was in the town buying thread. She got back to campground to find nothing but a dying fire, a bag of rocks, and her geography book propped up on a tree. They even took her tin cup. She had 6 copper pennies, 5 rocks, the geography book, and 2 spools of black thread, heavyweight number 30. Right there, she knew, she must decide on whether to get to Virginia or settle in a town where she would probably have to wear shoes. So she did both, the latter to make the former possible. With the 6 pennies, the book, the rocks, and the thread, she walked back to town. Black women worked in numbers at 2 places in that town, the laundry and, across the street from it, the hotel whorehouse. Pilate chose the laundry and walked in, saying to the 3 young girls, elbow deep in water there, "Can I stay here tonight? Nobody in here at night. I know. Can I stay?" They shrugged. The next day, Pilate was hired as a washerwoman at 10 cents a day. She worked there, ate there, slept there, and saved her dimes. Her hands, well calloused from years of harvesting, were stripped of their toughness and became soft in the wash water. Before her hands could get the different but equally tough skin of a laundress, her knuckles split with the rubbing and wringing and ran blood into the rinse tubs. She almost ruined an entire batch of sheets, but the other girls covered for her, giving the sheets a second rinse. One day she noticed a train steaming away from the town. "Where does it go to?" she asked. "South," they said. "How much does it cost?" They laughed. "They freight trains," they told her. "Only 2 passenger cars and no colored allowed." "Well, how do colored people get where they want to go?" "Ain't supposed to go nowhere," they said. "But if they do, have to go by wagon. Ask at the livery stable when the next wagon is going down. The livery people always know when somebody's getting ready to take off." She did. And by the end of October, just before the cold weather set in, she was on her way to West Virginia, which was close anyway, according to her geography book. When she got to Virginia itself, she realized that she didn't know in what part of the state to look for her people. There were more Negroes there than she'd ever seen, and the comfort she felt in their midst, she kept all her life. Pilate had learned, whenever she was asked her name, to give only her first name. The last name had a bad effect on people. Now she was forced to ask if anybody knew of a family called Dead. People frowned and said, "No, never heard of any such." She was in Culpeper, Virginia, washing clothes in a hotel when she learned that there was a colony of Negro farmers on an island off the coast of Virginia. They grew vegetables, had cattle, made whiskey, and sold a little tobacco. They did not mix much with other Negroes, but were respected by them and self-sustaining. And you could get to them only by boat. On a Sunday, she convinced the ferryman to take her there when his work was done in his skiff. "What you want over there?" he asked. "Work." "You don't want to work over there," he said. "Why not?" "Them folks keep to theyselves too much." "Take me, I'll pay." "How much?" "A nickel." "Great Jesus, you on. Be here at 9:30. There were 25 or 30 families on that island, and when Pilot made it clear that she wasn't afraid of work, but didn't like the mainland and the confinement of town, she was taken in. She worked there for 3 months, hoeing, fishing, plowing, planting, and helping out at the stills. All she had to do, she thought, was keep her belly covered. And it was true. At 16 now, she took a lover from one of the island families and managed to keep direct light from ever hitting her stomach. She also managed to get pregnant. And to the great consternation of the island women, who were convinced their menfolk were the most desirable on earth, which accounted for so much intermarrying among them, Pilot refused to marry the man, who was eager to take her for his wife. Pilot was afraid that she wouldn't be able to hide her stomach from a husband forever, and once he saw that uninterrupted flesh, he would respond the same way everybody else had. Yet, incredible as they found her decision, nobody asked her to leave. They watched over her and gave her fewer and lighter chores as her time drew near. When her baby was born, a girl, the two midwives in attendance were so preoccupied with what was going on between her legs, they never even noticed her smooth balloon of a stomach. The first thing the new mother looked for in her baby girl was the navel, which she was relieved to see. Remembering how she got the name that was folded in her ear, when the 9 days waiting was done, she asked one of the women for a Bible. There was a hymnal, they said, but not a Bible on the island. Everybody who wanted to go to services had to go to the mainland. "Can you tell me a nice name for a girl that's in the Bible?" Pilot asked. "Oh, plenty," they said, and reeled off a score, from which she chose Rebecca and shortened it to Reba. It was right after Reba was born that her father came to her again. Pilot had become extremely depressed and lonely after the birth. The baby's father was forbidden to see her, since she had not healed yet, and she spent some dark, lonely hours, along with the joyous ones, with the baby. "Clear as day," her father said. "Sing. Sing." And later, he leaned in at the window and said, "You just can't fly on off and leave a body." Pilot understood all of what he told her. To sing, which she did beautifully, relieved her gloom immediately. And she knew he was telling her to go back to Pennsylvania and collect what was left of the man she and Macon had murdered. The fact that she had struck no blow was irrelevant. She was part of her brother's act, because then she and he were one. When the child was 6 months old, she asked the mother of the baby's father to keep it and left the island for Pennsylvania. They tried to discourage her because it was getting to be winter, but she paid them no attention. A month later, she returned with a sack, the contents of which she never discussed, which she added to her geography book and the rocks and the 2 spools of thread. When Reba was 2 years old, Pilot was seized with restlessness. It was as if her geography book had marked her to roam the country, planting her feet in each pink, yellow, blue, or green state. She left the island and began the wandering life that she kept up for the next 20-some-odd years and stopped only after